Matrim Nishtamana, mothers, mothers. Tataimam Guru Rignatva, Natapneya Chatushtayam. Daitindram Darshayamasu, Matrim Rishmang Malankritam. Chata, thereafter, a nam, him, Prahlad Maharaj, Guru, his teachers, Natwa, knowing, Natta, known, Neya, which are to be known, Chatushtayam, the four diplomatic principles, Sama, the process of pacifying. Dhana, the process of giving money and charity. Bheda, the principle of dividing. And Dhanda, the principle of punishment. Daitya Indram unto Hiranyakashipu, the king of the Daityas. Darshayamasa presented Matrimirishtang, being bathed by his mother, Alankritam, decorated with ornaments. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation: after some time, the teachers, Sharanda and Amarka, thought that Prahlada Maharaj was sufficiently educated in the diplomatic affairs of pacifying public leaders, Sama, appeasing them by giving them lucrative posts, Dana, dividing and ruling over them, Veda, and punishing them in cases of disobedience, Danda. Then, one day, after Prahlada's mother had personally washed the boy and dressed him nicely with sufficient ornaments, they presented him before his father. Purport: it is essential for a student who is going to be a ruler or king to learn the four diplomatic principles. There is always rivalry between a king and his citizens. Therefore, when a citizen agitates the public against the king, the duty of the king is to call him and try to pacify him with sweet words, saying, "You are very important in the state. Why should you disturb the public with some new cause for agitation?" If the citizen is not pacified, the king should then offer him some lucrative post as a governor or minister, any post that draws a high salary, so that he may be agreeable. If the enemy still goes on agitating the public, the king should try to create dissension in the enemy's camp. But if he still continues, the king should employ argumentum ad baculum, severe punishment, by putting him in jail or placing him before a firing squad. Oh, that's funny. The teacher is appointed by Hiranyakashipu, taught Prahlada Maharaj how to be a diplomat so that he could rule over the citizens very nicely. So they continue to try to educate Prahlada Maharaj and friends and enemies, diplomatic affairs. For a king or ruler, these things, Prabhupada said, is essential for ruling the kingdom. So if there's some agitation by the subordinate dependents, then the leaders to first try to pacify them with some philosophy, some nice words. You see this in 10th canto, when Vasudev is trying to pacify Kamsa. So Kamsa is about to decapitate Mother Devaki. So Vasudev tries Sama, he tries to pacify him with philosophy. That doesn't work. Then it says here, then the king should try to give some lucrative post. Actually, this in Vasudev's example, he does that last. He promises to offer the children to Kamsa, give some dana, some donation. So, but here in sequence, dana is then applied, if they're still not pacified, then you give some post, some position to them, some form of charity. Barbara says here in context, any post that draws a high salary, then they become subdued. Like in India, if you get stopped by the police or something, then you just give some money, some 1,000 rupees. It's like we were traveling to Nepal, and there's a whole system of you've got to go out, sign some papers, and come back, and then the whole little system is there. But if you want to surpass all the trouble, you just give one some donation, dana. Then the person becomes pacified and makes some arrangement for you to come back in immediately. You don't even have to go out. They'll just sign some papers, stamp it, and go. Like this, it's called dana. That's not exactly a perfect example. This is for kings when dealing with agitating members of the society. So if pacification doesn't work, you give some money. If that doesn't work, then you beta. Beta means to separate. You create dissension in the enemy's camp. How you start spreading rumors about the leader or something, and everyone gets doubts. You create some dissension. Or you threaten. You threaten the opposing camp. And by threatening him, he becomes afraid. Beta, his intelligence becomes separate from his agenda by threats. Just like Vasudeva also tries beta with Kamsa. He says, by doing this, your reputation will be ruined. And in this way, he tries to separate Kamsa's intelligence from his imminent action of decapitating Mother Devaki. This is called his beta. And if that doesn't work, then finally, danda. Prabhupada uses this Latin term, argumentum ad baculum. So I looked it up, severe punishment. This is in logic, when you're not able to defeat a person with logical arguments, then you take shelter of this argumentum ad baculum, which means that if you don't accept what I'm saying, I'll bust you up, you know, something like that. You know, you make them intimidated. I'll shoot you, I'll kill you. And that way, it's not an appeal to the logic of the person, but it's appeal to human psychology, their fear of death or something like that, fear of punishment. So you circumvent actually using logic and just threaten them. I'll kick you out like this. And that way you try to get them to accept. Danda means literally stick, so you give punishment. So in this way, the teachers were educating Prahlad Maharaj how to be a diplomat so that he could rule over his citizens very nicely. After doing so, they thought, okay, now he is presentable to Hiranyakashipu. So the mother decorated him very nicely. Matre Mirshtam, bathed him and decorated him, Alankritam, very nicely. And then he was to be presented before his father, the king of the Daitas, Daitya Indran, Darshayamasa. Any questions about this?
It just struck me that, you know, we're discussing here how Prahlad was taught diplomacy and then he was presented before his father, a perfect opportunity to be diplomatic. And his father asked him, you know, what have you really studied? What is the best of all the subjects that you've studied? But he sort of spoke the truth. And just wondering, why do you think he did that?
Why was Prahlad Maharaj not diplomatic with his father? He rather just straightforwardly spoke the truth. Because he's Vaishnava. And the circumstances were such, he felt that that wasn't required. Vaishnava can also be diplomatic. So I gave example already, Vasudev and Kamsa. Vaishnava can also be diplomatic. He can cheat also, if necessary, for the purpose of Krishna. Prahlad Maharaj apparently didn't see any necessity to do so. Rather, he saw an opportunity to enlighten his father in Krishna consciousness. So he just spoke straightforward. Generally, again, this is again for rulers also. Generally speaking, a Vaishnava may do anything for the services of Krishna. But as far as if he's in some position, he may usually serve in that particular position as is socially acceptable. So this is particularly required for kings. So he was a king, a prince, in training. Otherwise, Brahmanas are not generally diplomatic. Brahmanas are very straightforward. Therefore, the kings would be ruled or govern, so to speak, or take guidance from Brahmanas. Brahmanas would be very objective and speak very straightforwardly, no diplomacy. Therefore, when wanting to hear spiritual reality, you would go to them, generally. Because they're not generally diplomatic. you're just flat. So different culture. This is a culture for the Kshatriyas, like that. He was Vaishnava, he obviously didn't see the necessity to be diplomatic, so he spoke straightforwardly about Krishna consciousness. Yeah. I'm going to move on. Well, the next verse, text 20, Padayo Patitam Balam Pratinandya Shivshasura Parishwagya Charam Dorbhyam Paramapa Nirvitam. Translation: when Hiranyakashipu saw that his child had fallen at his feet and was offering obeisances, as an affectionate father, he immediately began showering blessings upon the child, and embraced him with both arms. A father naturally feels happy to embrace his son, and Hiranyakashipu became very happy in this way, at least ostensibly. Next verse, Aropyang Kamabhagrahya Murdhanyashru Kalambubhihi Asinchan Vikasa Bhaktram Idham Ah Yudhishthira. Narada Muni continued, my dear King Yudhishthira, Hiranyakashipu seated Prahlada Maharaj on his lap and began smelling his head. With affectionate tears gliding, at least ostensibly so, with affectionate tears gliding down from his eyes and moistening the child's smiling face, he spoke to his son as follows. Purport. If a child or disciple falls at the feet of the father or spiritual master, the superior responds by smelling the head of the subordinate. End of purport. So I guess that's an interesting cultural point. Sorry. Next verse, text 22. Hiranyakashipu vacha prahadhanu chitam tata swadhitam kejendutamam kalenai tavata yushman yadashiksha guru bhavan. Translation, Hiranyakashipu said, my dear Prahlad, my dear son, O long-lived one, for so much time you have heard many things from your teachers. Now please repeat to me whatever you think is the best of that knowledge. Purport. In this verse, Hiranyakashipu inquires from his son what he has learned from his guru. Prahlada Maharaj's gurus were of two kinds, Shanda and Amarka, the sons of Shukracharya, and the seminal disciple succession were the gurus appointed by his father, but his other guru was the exalted Narada Muni, who had instructed Prahlad, and Prahlad was within the womb of his mother. Prahlada Maharaj responded to the inquiry of his father with the instructions he had received from his spiritual master, Narada. Thus, there was again a difference of opinion because Prahlada Maharaj wanted to relate the best thing he had learned from his spiritual master, whereas Hiranyakashipu expected to hear about the politics and diplomacy Prahlada had learned from Shanda and Amarka. Now the dissension between the father and son became increasingly intense as Prahlada Maharaj began to say what he had learned from his guru, Narada Muni. Sorry, Hiranyakashipu asked, what did you learn from your teacher? He should have said, what did you learn from Shanda and Amarka? Should have been specific. But he just said, generally, Yadaksha Guru Bhavan. What have you learned from your gurus, Bhavan, your good self? What does your good self learn from your guru? So he had two types of gurus, material guru and spiritual guru. Material master and spiritual master. So the material master he didn't consider really guru. So he related what he learned from his spiritual master, Narada Muni. So that was unexpected. Again, this will lead to, as Prabhupada is saying here, the dissension between the father and son became increasingly intense because of, again, relating what he had learned from his spiritual master. Any questions? Very straightforward.
I was going to ask a different question, but I'll ask a question.
The next
about,
verse has
no.
Been.
Oh, okay,
the
go
next
ahead.
Verse is like a 15-page purport. Seriously. We're going to begin it. We're not going to finish it. We're going to start it, though. Next verse. That's fine.
So you were making, in this purport, Mason, the point that it was two gurus we usually listen to, our material master or spiritual master, and Prahlad says the mind is the greatest enemy. So this actually reminds me of the point that, in regards to hearing, the point that was made yesterday, I think, by Rasika Manjari, that back in the old days, they didn't have, you know, MP3 players, or they would see the guru rarely, so they'll be grateful for whatever hearing. So the real hearing wasn't like all the time, you know, the real hearing is the internal hearing. So, because even when we're in class, we may be so far away. So how can we distinguish between basically real hearing, you know, like Nityananda Prabhu made the point that when your favorite speaker comes up, you're very enthusiastic and you hear it, you know, excellently.
Then
when
naturally, you're so.
Yeah, naturally, that's natural. So how, and when you're, you know, least favorite, your hearing's out the window, you don't hear anything. So how can we,
That's if you're real.
Neophyte? That pretty much answered my question.
What is the question?
That was pretty much, how can we distinguish what's actually hearing? Because some people may not be are able to physically hear, like, let's say, all the time, as certain people, MP3s, or hear your spiritual master all the time. But does it necessarily mean that just because you're hearing all the time, does that actually mean you're hearing? That was my question. How do we distinguish between what's actually hearing?
There's no question of hearing unless you're surrendered, first of all. Tavidi panipatena pariprashnena sevaya. Isn't it? This verse is there. That, what is the rest of the verse? Ubadekshanti te jnanam garinas tattva darshina. Ubadekshanti means they initiate the spiritual master, tattva darshi, guru. He initiates one into transcendental knowledge. So you got to hear that. So what's the first requirement? Pariprashna means surrender. You got to submit. Otherwise, no question in here. No question, practically speaking. Only argument. Without surrender, then only argument happening. Then after that, pariprashna means you have to ask relevant questions. Understand, relevant. Generally, the tendency is we're thinking of our own point, and we never ask a question pertaining to the actual discussion or what the speaker is actually covering. We just have our own ideas of something, then we ask something. Just like I many times do this exercise with devotees. I'll ask them what the class is about, and they'll tell me what they liked about the class. Those are two different things. You understand? I ask what the class is about, and they'll tell me what they like about it. And I notice how even devotees take notes. They'll write down sentences that they liked in the class. And then from that particular sentence, their mind will start going off in some speculative realm about what they deem to be Krishna consciousness or whatever. But they never can actually tell you what the class is about. The class is about something. There's a systematic... Krishna is actually talking about something when he's speaking Gita. He's actually developing his discussion. First, there's knowledge of the soul, then there's the process of how to realize the soul in six chapters, then it culminates in bhakti, then a discussion for bhakti in six chapters, and so on. Krishna's actually developing a discussion there, and you're just writing down what points you like. That means you're not hearing. You're only, whatever, your so-called hearing is in terms of like and dislike. I like this sentence. Oh, I didn't like that one. I'm discarding that. I like this sentence. I didn't like that one. Discard. No hearing. What is the class about? How is Krishna developing the topic? You know, and if you didn't understand that, you inquire about that. That's called relevant question. You know, you just pick up on one little sentence in the course of a discussion, and then you feel like, okay, I see how that particular sentence pertains to me. That may have some value on an emotional level. But how will it improve your intelligence? How will it help you deepen your meditation on the actual discussion that's going on between, let's say, Krishna Arjuna or the personality of the Bhagavatam? You know, so you may relate to, you know, generally that's what happens. We relate on an emotional level. So I like that sentence. That's all emotional. And not that there's no room for emotion, please. Of course there must be some feeling there. But then how is your intelligence to improve? if you don't actually meditate on what the discussion is about. And many times we don't have that ability to do so in the outset, like from the first time hearing about it. So then, therefore, paripashna is required. Inquiry about that. Jivasya tata jignasa, isn't it? Nartashashcheya, karma bhi. Right now, said the Bhagavatam, it says this human form of life is meant for inquiry into the truth, the tattva. There's so many tattvas, are there? Nam tattva, bhakti tattva, guru tattva, so many tattvas to understand. So it says this human form of life is meant for that, inquiring into the truth, the tattvas. And nothing else should be the goal of one's work or activity. Nartashashcheya, karma bhi. So then I noticed that this is another problem with hearing. I've often mentioned these 4 points from the, I think the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, if I recall properly. These 4 qualifications for hearing properly was mentioned. And one of them is mind. The first one was mentioned as mind and sense control. So this is required. What is the speaker actually talking about and not just what is resonating with you? That, of course, is going to be a part of the discussion, what resonates with you. But also, what is he talking about? You understand? He, she, what are they talking about? Not just what is resonating with, that's all emotion. This one sounds good. That sounds spiritual. That one makes me feel inspired. That makes me feel good. Okay, that's great. And what is the actual thing being discussed? I see that so many times in the way devotees take their notes. Just like this kid, I asked him to study Nectar of Instruction, to give bullet points of everything being discussed in each shloka, at least up to the first 7. So he showed me his notes, and it was just, thanks to my education, cut and paste sentences from the purport. And he probably cut and pasted the whole thing, probably. So I was like, if I wanted to read Nectar of Instruction, I'll read it from the book. I'll not read it from your smartphone. This is not bullet notes. This is, you know, oh, I like that sentence, I resonate with that sentence. That's not hearing. How are you hearing then? What is it? Okay, that's nice. That's one aspect. There needs to be some affective side. But what is it? What is actually being discussed? What is the topic? How, unless you're able to meditate on that, how your intelligence will improve. So most of the time our intelligence doesn't improve. We remain highly emotional. Then you can't get out of maya. Esham tatakatam papam jananam punya karmana. One has to become free from I like, I dislike. This is the bewildering potency of maya. Maya bewilders the condition of soul in different ways, Krishna discussed in chapter 7. Chapter 7 is more or less a discussion of how maya bewilders the condition of souls in so many verses. One way she bewilders the condition of souls is by giving them bad intelligence not to surrender to Krishna. And 4 types are described. Then she bewilders the conditioned souls by inspiring them to surrender to ephemeral objects, like the celestials are given as an example. People don't have faith in the celestials, so now it's just some movie star or something like that. Then Maya bewilders them by inspiring them to speculate about the nature of the absolute without hearing from any authority. This is called as aparoksha, the negative aparoksha, knowledge. Then the last way Maya bewilders them is by getting them absorbed in I like, I dislike. This one I like, that one I don't like. Itra dvesha samutena dwanda mohena bharata. Sarvabhutani samoham sarge yanti parantapa. From the very beginning of the birth, the living entities are intensely bewildered by the delusion of duality based on desire and hate accumulated as impressions from their previous life. Itra dvesha samutena. So like that, then in the hearing, you're on this duality platform. I like this one, I don't like that. Not hearing. No question. Then after hearing, there's mention, so Tavidi Paripashna, Paripatena, Paripashna, Sevaya. Then Seva, you got to do some service, render devotional service, something like that. So this thing is very difficult. That's why I'm always asking devotees, what is the class about? What did you understand? Oh, I like this sentence, I like that sentence. Then I chastise them. If anyone says like that, then they get scared. I said, what was the class about? They become nervous. anyway, just to help us improve, what was the actual thing about? Just like it would be easy, like we only cover a few verses a day in the Bhagavatam class. And for that reason, it takes forever to get through the Bhagavatam. And it's very hard to learn like that also, the Bhagavatam, if you really want to learn. Generally, that's why you have to have your own side study. Otherwise, no one's going to learn the Bhagavatam like this. No question. But you will learn. You'll get impressions of some gist of Bhakti Tattva and so on. Some gist. You'll get some gist out of that by just hearing like what we do in the classes. But you'll not get a comprehensive understanding of Bhagavatam. I guess the classes weren't meant to do that, clearly, because it doesn't happen. And when I joined 12 years ago, we were on the first canto, and we're just making it to the seventh canto after 12 years. So you think I learned the Bhagavatam like that? No question learning the Bhagavatam. But even though that's the formula, you know, I guess it's Prabhupada's system, you know. We say like that. I have different opinions. I feel like the principle is devotees should gather together and hear and chant the Bhagavatam. That's the principle. And the detail is how you want to do that. So Prabhupada did it in one way at that time. That's a detail. And it could be done in other ways also. As long as the principle is maintained of community of devotees getting together and discussing the Bhagavatam. That's the principle. Anyway, so there are differing opinions. So I'm of a particular opinion. But anyway, even in the method that we follow now, you know, which is Prabhupada's system, you know, just throw that rubric on it and it makes it inscrutable, you know, or how you say? You can't. And unquestionable and inviolable, how you say that? You can't violate that. You just snap, Prabhupada's system. Now no one can question it, no one can violate the principle. So even if we take that point, still you can learn about it. You read on your own. You see how the thought is developing. You know, read the whole chapter yourself and see what is the development of thought going on. So that when you're covering the one or two verses in class, there's no confusion. There's clarity. Or at least it starts to become improved. Okay, I missed that, how the thought was actually developing. Like this. There's still ways you can learn, even in this method, which is generally inefficient as far as learning is concerned. But it's still possible if you're sincere. But you have to have control mind and senses. Control mind. Don't just hear what you liked. Try to understand what is being discussed. Then intelligence will improve. You want to say something?
Even like, oh my gosh, if we haven't read even like we've barely started the first canto, and then we're covering the seventh canto in class, then should we try to really go through like the seventh canto, or should we just like take a class but try to catch up and read the prior?
And in your personal time, you can start from first canto, and because this is like you can consider it. Instead of it being like the ritual of the morning program, one of the dry rituals that we carry on through somehow or other, you can think of it as a study session. It's a study session from 7:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. in the morning. So along with your personal study, which may start from the first canto or something like that, wherever you're at, then this class, you also studying that particular section of the Bhagavatam also. So you leave some time for its study also. Because practically speaking, all the same points are being made everywhere. The same principles of Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan are being made everywhere and just from different angles of vision. So it need not be necessary that you have to start from the beginning. Although in some ways there is a progress of thought. Still you can learn so much by just taking the time out to study that particular section and come to class thinking it's a study session. Another study session. From 7:30 to 8:00. Instead of thinking it's like, okay, it's a class I gotta go to, you know, alright, like that. It can become nice. Like that. We tried to inspire, but it was very difficult. Alright, yeah. When I was studying, well, I read the Bhagavatam straight. When I first joined, it took me about 10 months and I was reading like 4 to 6 hours every day, because I was rising very early, and I would study for 2 hours before Mangalarti. Then I would chant my japa. Then I was doing Sankirtan that time for 2 years. And we had to go by train. So it takes 2 hours to get to O'Hare by train. So then I was studying on the train also. So I ended up studying about 4 to 6 hours a day. So I got through the Balacham in like 6 months, or 10 months. I think it was about 10 months when I finished it. You think I learned Balacham very nicely like that? Not exactly. But I was just trying to get it in my system, you know? I was just trying to get the Balacham in my system. Because I was new, and devotees would be speaking so many stories from the Balacham, this and that. They'll just say Bali Maharaj, and then go to the next point. I'm like, who's Bali Maharaj, you know? That has no meaning to me, you know? And so I would be quite confused. So I just wanted to get it in my system. So I read Balacham just like that. Then again, and then again, like this. Then later on, the commentaries of some of the Acharyas came out, so I started reading along with that to get some greater comprehension of Prabhupada's book. And I read, the general principle is to read as fast as you can understand when you're studying something. If you're just trying to get in your system, you can just read. But if you're trying to understand something, you should read as fast as you can understand. So sometimes that may be one verse for an hour, or it may be a whole chapter. But you read as fast as you're able to understand. Otherwise, how is it going to get in you if you can't understand what you're reading? Just going through the ritual of reading 1 hour there or something is going to. I've studied just a single purport for a couple hours before trying to understand. I've done that before where I'm like, oh, this doesn't make any sense to me. And so I'll just sit there with it, of course. As fast as you can understand, you move. Like this. Okay. Anything else? Alright, I'll go on a little bit more. This famous verse is there. You can repeat after me. This one, you first line, you will be doing. Sri Prahlada Uvacha Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam Padasevanam Archanam Vandanam Dasyam Sakyam Atma Nivedanam Iti pung sarpita vishnau bhakti shtenavalakshana kriyita bhagavatyadha tanmanye ditamutamam ditamutamam. Translation, Palamar said, hearing and chanting about the transcendental holy name, form, qualities, and paraphernalia and pastimes of the Lord Vishnu, remembering them, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, offering the Lord respectful worship with 16 types of paraphernalia, offering prayers to the Lord, becoming his servant, considering the Lord one's best friend, and surrendering everything unto him. In other words, serving him with the body, mind, and words. These nine processes are accepted as pure devotional service. One who has dedicated his life to the service of Krishna through these nine methods should be understood to be the most learned person, for he has acquired complete knowledge. So this is Prahlada Maharaj's answer to his father. Needless to say, he wasn't thrilled to hear it. Purport. When Prahlada Maharaj was asked by his father to say something, from whatever he had learned, he considered that what he had learned from his spiritual master was the best of all teachings, whereas what he had learned about diplomacy from his material teachers, Shanda and the Marka, was useless. This is how we feel when we come to Krishna consciousness. Whatever we learned from our first book, you know, trumped whatever we learned in 12 years of high school or 4 years in college, you know, all we consider useless. And Prabhupada says, this is the indication of bhakti. Next sentence. Bhakti paresha nubhavo virakter anyatra cha. This is a symptom of pure devotional service. What is this? What is this? This is the symptom. thinking whatever material knowledge you gained up until that point is completely useless. That means bhakti is coming up. If you still think some of this other stuff is valuable, then bhakti has not sprouted so far. Not that we, not anyway, I'm being a little playful. But idea is, this is reality. Whatever material knowledge we gained, actually we felt like this. We had a hunch before we joined Krishna consciousness. And then after we joined, it became confirmed. You know, just like for myself, I was always, you know, I often mention this, I was, you know, in search of love and all these things. And I got a hunch, there is no love in this material world. So I asked my mother 3 weeks before I read SSR for the first time, stumbled upon it. And my mother, everyone finds love. And she gave something, and I was like, nah. I said, that just sounds not accurate, you know. And then I read SSR and Prabhupada's letter to Lynn Lugwin, and she's complaining that Prabhupada's disciples are so negative. And she says, we should let love be, and love is. And she was speaking like this real, like, new agey. And Prabhupada's response, and, you know, the first paragraph, he apologizes for his disciples being a little neophyte and maybe overindulging in those negative things because they're afraid of being victims of Maya. But then after that, the letter is long, too. After that, Prabhupada's like, but you should know this world is negative. And the rest of the letter is just about how the world is negative. And then you can read it. It's in SSR. It's a very beautiful letter, actually. Prabhupada took so much time to respond. She wasn't even a devotee. And in the letter, at one point, he says, as far as love is concerned, you've mentioned love many times in your letter, but as far as love is concerned, you should know that there is no love in this material world. And I was like, I knew it. When I was reading it, you know, I was like, I had the hunch, but it got confirmed. So similarly, probably before joining devotional service, we had a hunch that this material knowledge is useless. Most devotees, this is a useless waste of time. But then after coming to Bhagavatam, then you confirm. So probably this is a symptom of pure devotional service. You consider material knowledge. A pure devotee is interested only in devotional service, not in material affairs. To execute devotional service, one should always engage in hearing and chanting about Krishna or Lord Vishnu. Not vegetarian. The process of temple worship is called archana. How to perform archana will be explained herein. That means later on in the purport. One should have complete faith in the words of Krishna, who says that he is the great well-wishing friend of everyone, Sudhidham Sarabhutanam. A devotee considers Krishna the only friend. This is called Sakyam. So that was just like a gloss of some of the items on the list. Prabhupada continues, Kungsarpita Vishnu. The word Kungsa means by all living entities. There are no distinctions permitting only a man or only a brahmana to offer devotional service to the Lord. Everyone can do so. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verse 32, Shtriya Vaishyas Tata Shudras Tepi Yanti Param Gatam. Although women, Vaishyas, and Shudras are considered less intelligent, they also can become devotees and return home back to Godhead. So the idea here is that pure devotional service is not dependent on any type of material criteria. Even those who are highly situated in the sattva guna, highly intelligent such as brahmanas or even higher, rishis and sages, they may be devoid of bhakti or bhakti tattva gyan. They may be devoid of even knowledge. Whereas those situated in the lower modes of nature, like passionate ignorance, may get it. Such as the example given, I was just studying this yesterday. The example given is of Vitrasura. Parashrit Maharaj inquired, he had a mode of passionate ignorant nature, demon body, and yet he had this bhakti tattva again. He got it. Whereas these great sages and rishis, devatas, brahmanas, and high mortal goodness, they don't get it. So what does this indicate? That bhakti is not dependent on any material criteria. Even the type of body you have, you can have an elephant body also and get bhakti. That we were hearing yesterday. Narayanaya. What is that? Narayanaya. Hibhavanti parasta punso. Bhaktiya tutosha bhagavan gajayutapaya. Prahlad Maharaj is praying. Lord Nishingadev. He's trying to understand how it is that even all these great devatas, they're in high mode of goodness. They offer beautiful poetic words to the Lord, and the Lord was like, cold. Or in that case, he was, you know, with his thousands of arms and, you know, blood everywhere. He was furious. So they tried to pacify him. Nothing was pacifying the Lord. So then Prahlad Maharaj steps forward, immediately Nrisimhadeva became peaceful. So he's trying to understand how this is possible. Even a person is so qualified, then in his second prayer, he gives a long list of material qualifications. We read this the other day. High aristocratic birth, wealth, beauty, education, mystic power, sensory prowess, intelligence, long list. 12 items were given, long list. Anything that could be desirable on the material platform. But then he says, Naradanaya hibhavanti parasupum, so even by all those things, you cannot be satisfied. So then what satisfies the Lord? I mean, that's a lot of things. And bhaktya tutosha bhagavan, only by bhakti does the Lord become satisfied. Then he gives an example. Who does he give as an example? Gajayutapaya, Gajendra he gives as an example. Why he gives Gajendra as an example? Why didn't he give some other personality as an example? Because he wanted to demonstrate the extraordinary nature of bhakti. That even, it is so independent that even it can come in an animal body, which is probably inconceivable. Even Bharat Maharaj in his body as a deer, before leaving that deer body, he offered beautiful prayers to the Lord in a deer body. That would be something extraordinary to see. You see a deer at the altar. That would be far out. It might also be a little scary. You might get a little nervous if you saw something like that, you know? A deer just walk up in here and just go to the altar and... Actually, I just saw something just the other day, maybe yesterday, of a dog when it was taken to the grave of its master. The grave, so the master had died. The dog was showing so much affection. Anyway, that's a material example. But bhakti, to offer prayers, that's something... The dog was just missing his food supply, you know? So there's nothing spiritual there. But if you see a deer come in and offer prayers to the Lord, that would be extraordinary. Or you see like a deer come in and offer obeisances. And then get up and go to the next altar. That would be really far out. Such is the nature of transcendental nature of bhakti. It's not depending on any sort of material criteria. No material criteria. So you can be in passion and ignorance and get bhakti also. That doesn't mean, great, I'll keep myself in passion and ignorance. And actually, if you're getting more and more bhakti, you'll come up, you'll become elevated. But even if you're in passion and ignorance, such persons can get bhakti. And even though situated in high mode of goodness, they may not get it. What does this mean? Bhakti is supremely independent, understand? So, Prabhupada in giving the purport to Pungsarpita Vishnu, Prabhupada says the word Pumsa means by all living entities. So any living entity can get it. And any sort of life form, human life form or otherwise, they can get it. Because bhakti is supremely independent. And there's also to say that bhaktas are supremely independent. They can give it to anyone because bhakti is distributed in this world through bhaktas. And they can give it to anyone. Even Shivananda Sain and Gaur Lila gave bhakti to a dog. So it is. So in this way, Prabhupada is giving commentary. Anyone can get it. No matter what type of body you have, Lord and Shudra also, woman body also, Vaishya body, Brahminical body, anybody can get it or nobody can get it. I understand? Anybody or nobody, according to Bhakti's sweet will. We'll read a little bit more, huh? Oh, a question about that? Then we might have to stop with the question. Yeah. I wanted to go all the way up to anyone. I will do it.
This is kind of a controversial topic in our movement right now about, you know, preaching to Westerners. Because what's happened is you see in North America, many of our temples, it's mostly people of Indian origin. And so devotees have given different reasons as to why so many Westerners are not coming to bhakti anymore. And sometimes it becomes, we were reading that essay together about the cultural aspect that one would have to be familiar with to understand bhakti, this culture of selflessness, respect, relationship, things like that. I was wondering if you could
just say, just added on that point in the article you were you're mentioning. It didn't say you would have to be familiar with that.
It would be
those
helpful.
Were presented as obstacles in our taking in devotion. Mm-hmm. Okay. Not that that was the requirement for starting it.
Now, I've always understood the principle that, like this verse is beautifully describing, devotees can give bhakti to anyone. So, your background, your social status, your cultural build-up, whatever is, you know, it's not really that big of a deal. But still, we see that practically speaking, Westerners find it very difficult to take to bhakti, in many cases. So, although the principle is that it can go to anyone, somehow there's been a shift in the social demographic of our society.
Yeah, I can't, you know, my sense of it, because it's not that Westerners aren't taking it. Westerners in America aren't taking it so much. But in other places, it's bhakti movements are spreading. Russia, Europe, South America. My sense of it is in America is too much offense culture going on. That's why nothing is able to sprout up. That's a personal opinion. So there may be. Otherwise, Kali Kalera Dharma, Krishna Nama Sankirtana, Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tadar Parvartan. That unless one is empowered by Krishna Shakti, they cannot spread Krishna consciousness to even one person. Kali Kalera Dharma, Krishna Nama Sankirtan. This Dharma of Kali Yuga is Nam Sankirtan. And only those who are invested with Krishna Shakti can spread it. So I asked my spiritual master this one time about spreading Krishna consciousness to colleges and this and that. And he said, well, the first and foremost principle is you have to be empowered. So sometimes there may be a lack of humility in acknowledging our lack of empowerment. And that maybe we just need to become ourselves more and more Krishna conscious. We're just not empowered in that way. We're empowered enough to follow the four regs, which is itself a great accomplishment for where many from the backgrounds many of us are coming from. That itself takes extraordinary empowerment to keep ourselves from, you know, not acting totally nonsensical. But we may not be empowered enough to spread Krishna consciousness. At least that's a factor. That may not be the whole story, but that's certainly a factor. Just like there's big thing about dress, you know, some devotees making big hullabaloo about dress. Because we dress like this and not like that, therefore bhakti isn't spreading. And it started a whole little movement where you can dress like, you know, Westerners, and that's going to help bhakti spread. Did bhakti spread? No, that thing is falling apart like anything. I'm not mentioning the name. Some of you may know what I'm talking about. So, obviously, it is clear that this bhakti is a transcendental thing. It's not depending on any sort of material circumstance or situation or anything. And I think this just, you know, and I think also sometimes we get bewildered because we want to compare ourselves to Srila Prabhupada, or we think we have to do it as big or as much, as far extending as Srila Prabhupada. And therefore, actually, people are coming for it. Look at the temple room. People are coming for it. I think probably historically, traditionally, you didn't see Christian consciousness spreading the way it was during Prabhupada's time. Except for during Lord Chaitanya's time, but that was only in India. Prabhupada is particularly unique, even amongst avatars of Vishnu. Seriously. Even amongst avatars of Vishnu, Prabhupada is standing out. You know, Vishnu is giving him the credit as his great bhakta. So we can hardly think to do it like Srila Prabhupada. He has some sort of, you know, extraordinary, inconceivable empowerment that is not comparable practically even for avatars of Vishnu. You don't see them manifesting such potency. So I sometimes feel like we get, we feel like it has to spread like that. But probably speaking before Srila Bhakti Siddhanta and Srila Prabhupada, one, two people were getting at a time, you know. One, two people stepping forward. So probably speaking, Krishna consciousness is spreading more or less at the same rate. That's my sense of it. And Prabhupada was kind of like an atom bomb of bhakti. And it just, you know, exploded and spread across planet Earth. Probably hit some of the other planets in the universe, and they got a little bit of it too, you know. So every now and then, Krishna just decided to throw an atom bomb. Srila Prabhupada. You know, some extraordinary, inconceivable bhakti. you know, manifesting in him and spreading. But for the rest, it may not spread like that, but it is spreading in its own way. So, yeah, we have to know, we have to at least acknowledge. So I gave a few things. I didn't really speak about it methodically. But one element is that offense culture makes it hard for people to take to bhakti. Another thing is we have to acknowledge, at least some of us have to acknowledge, our lack of empowerment to spread Krishna consciousness. And as such, a need to, let's say, spread the influence of Krishna Shakti in our heart by augmenting our own Krishna consciousness. And maybe spending less time trying to convert or proselytize, or and more time trying to spread the Krishna consciousness movement in our own heart. You know, there should be movement internally. Krishna consciousness movement means to move a person from the state of unaccomplishment to the state of accomplishment. That's movement. Otherwise, it becomes Krishna conscious static. One devotee joked with me like this the other day. I thought it was quite funny. Or Krishna conscious inertia. You know, you started off and you were going real strong for like a year or two, you know, if you were doing really good. And then it's just like, you know, like a sort of non-movement. So the offense culture is one problem why Krishna consciousness is not taking ground in people's hearts. Offense culture, especially, it's augmented by internet, you know, particularly. The speech is the primary way in which we commit offenses. You generally don't see someone killing Vaishnava and so on. Now, I mean, that happens also. But that's not like the most common thing you hear about. What you hear about, that's the problem. So much talking, and it's been augmented by internet. And because people lack Krishna consciousness, they don't know how to stay away from those things. They want to chime in, you know, okay, yeah, he really got me going there, you know, and you're spending like 2 or 3 hours on the computer thinking that you're doing something to benefit the world, and you're just committing Vaishnava parad. So that's one reason why Krishna consciousness doesn't take ground. That's my sense of it, particularly in America. Also, a lack of faith in sadhu is another element that is, I feel, prominently perceived in America. Because in other places where Krishna consciousness is spreading, they have a lot of faith in sadhus. Just like some of our ISKCON sannyasis, for example, they go to Russia or you go to Croatia or something, they're still greeted at the airport with a huge party, kirtan party. They have so much faith in sadhu. Here in America, the sannyasis got a call and say, "Is anyone coming to pick me up?" The situation has become so dire in America. Is anyone, "Oh yeah, Mars, they'll be there in probably like 20 minutes. You know, you could just hang out by the corner, you know." It's become so heavy. And then sadhu is speaking. The material vision, we were hearing this yesterday, watching Gorgo and the Marsh together, some of us. There's adduction of people. Those who think they have measuring rod in their hand, they can measure sadhu. So this empiricism, in other words, is a great challenge to the culture of bhakti. And by empiricism, not only are we trying to understand God, thinking he can be subordinate to our logic, but also in perceiving bhaktas, guru, because they are also integral aspects of the absolute. We hear this in CC, that the absolute truth is one truth that manifests sixfold way. So guru and bhakta is integral to the very nature of Krishna. In other words, they're part of the super subjective plane. We use this language from Srila Sridhar Maharaj, or supra. It's transcending our own subjectivity. But we think that sadhus and devotees are objects to be seen. And that way, with our empirical vision, we indulge in this culture of offense. So these are two problems. There are lack of faith in sadhu, offense culture. Then there's just, we have to acknowledge a lack of empowerment. Therefore, the need to spread the Krishna conscious movement in our own heart. Like this is my sense of it. Otherwise, picking up on these other points, because we didn't wear this dress, therefore people didn't take, that is all external. That's Bahirmukha understanding, externally orientated, exterior understanding. There's so many people who wear this dress, and they're making people devotees also.
on this point about respect for sadhus in Eastern Europe, I saw a video of Bhakti Vidyapurna Maharaj arriving at New Rajadham, and it was unbelievable. Like, they had a full kirtan party. They washed his feet. They did guru puja to him. It was just like a regular summer visit, you know, nothing special. There wasn't his Vyasa Puja or anything. So I was kind of like, wow, it's really amazing. I had a question, though. So we understand that the way the modes of nature work is that when we're conditioned by a certain mode of nature, then in our environment, we're attracted to activities that resonate with that mode of nature. So an individual might recognize that his tendencies are very much in the mode of passion. And mode of passion is usually very result-oriented. Make it big, focus on the result. And then one may, after hearing from sadhus, get the realization that, like, you made a very beautiful point that we have a tendency to compare to how Srila Prabhupada did things, you know, and we should understand that that's just not going to be possible, because that kind of empowerment was very rare, even amongst the avatars of Vishnu. It was such a beautiful point, I've never heard it put like that before. But because we have this mode of passion tendency, then we, in our environment, as an individual, might identify with activities that are more in the mode of passion, so big, result-oriented, stuff like that. But after hearing from sadhus, he may get the intelligence that, no, instead of focusing on the big impact outside, let me focus on the big impact within. But he might find a duality within his nature and his intelligence. And you know, he may be giving in to his to the nature many times and neglecting what he has heard. And then sometimes he may pay attention to what he's heard. So what do you advise to someone like that
it's inbuilt in what you just said. Don't neglect what you hear. Is inbuilt. Whatever you just said, you gave the answer. You said they may neglect what they hear, so don't neglect what you hear. Otherwise, how you make progress? Isn't it?
Like, in order to hear, you have to surrender. So if you're neglecting what you've heard, you're not rejecting things unfavorable. You're not accepting things favorable. So that neglects the whole hearing process altogether.
Hearing is, of course, like I've often mentioned, you have to be trained how to hear. Hearing is not something that is easily achieved. Why is it not easily achieved? Also, I thought about this also. Why is Shravan, Kirtanam, Smaranam, etc., why are these processes not easily achieved? You have to receive the mercy of sadhu. That's also true. We're attached to our old way of thinking. That is also true. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, he writes in one letter, I saw this as mind-boggling. He said, after 40 years of preaching, I have not met even one sincere person. Then he gives an import to that. He said, I speak Hari Katha to them in one moment, and in the next moment, they cannot relinquish their dependence on their own intelligence and understanding. So he's defined what lack of sincerity is, an inability to relinquish our own understanding. And instead of taking the katha, we just... That is also true. And there's another reason also. Why is Shravana and Kirtan, Smaranam, etc., why are these processes hard to obtain? There's not faith. Okay, some of these points are correct. There's another reason, though. We're not simple. Okay, that's also true. All of these points are also true. There's another reason, though, because Shravanam, Kirtan, Smaranam, etc., these are the natural expressions of prema. As their primary, the word is Swarup Lakshana used by Lord Chaitanya. The primary, let's say, purpose of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, I'll use that word purpose, is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam. Bhaktiya Sanjataya Bhaktiya. I often mention this quote from the Bhagavatam. Bhakti is for bhakti's sake, isn't it? Bhakti is not for the sake of anyone but the Absolute. Or bhakti is for bhakti's sake. So we do sadhana bhakti for getting prema bhakti. So bhakti, the intrinsic nature of bhakti is... Shravanam Kirtanam, bhakti means Shravanam Kirtanam Smaranam, etc. So bhakti for bhakti's sake means Shravanam for Shravanam's sake, ultimately. Kirtanam for Kirtanam's sake. Smaranam for Smaranam's sake. Not for gaining anything from the Absolute. Rather, that is pleasing the Absolute, so it is for His purposes only. So we hear. So as a secondary feature for sadhakas, it awakens love. That is secondary consideration. That I can get my prema by doing shravana. And then, you know, that's primary in terms of our consideration. But it's actually secondary in terms of the truth. The primary purpose of Shravanam is Shravanam itself. In other words, it's completely transcendental. That is why it's hard to obtain. That's my point of bringing this up. The reason it's hard to attain Shravanam, just like prema is hard to attain, there's no doubt about that, isn't it? Anyone here got prema yet? What about bhav? No bhav? Sakti? Taking a sakti? No? Ruchi? Sadhusanga? That's pretty good. At least you got faith. Some people don't even got that. So why is it, just as prema is hard to attain, bhava is sudurlabha, rarely attained, so also shravanam, kirtanam, smarana is rarely attained. You understand? Normally you don't think of it like this. We think, I sit down in the class and I'll just hear. But just as bhava and prema is sudurlabha, so bhakti's natural expression is shravanam, kirtanam. So that means that is also rarely obtained. But if it's going to be attained at all, it can only be attained by bhakti, sadhana bhakti. So we begin our practices, which has come by the grace of sadhu. So that's why all your points were actually interconnected. And coming by the grace of sadhu, how would it be possible? That verse is given by Mahaprabhu. Gane prayasam udapasya namanta eva. Jivanti samukaritam bhavadeya vratam. What does that mean? Gane prayasam udapasya means whatever understanding that I've gained from my worldly experience, throw it out. You know, just like I'm in a 12-story building. I'll take all that killer load of worldly experience and then watch it. If you don't do that, how you will hear from sadhu? You understand? You only argue with sadhu. While sadhu is speaking, you'll be countering every point. No, that ain't right. That ain't right either. That sounds all right, but I don't know if I really trust that. You know, like that. That will be going on because of the worldly experience. This is how Maya traps the conditioned soul. I already quoted. It's your dvesha sammutena dvandamoyena bhara. That's how Maya traps. So gane prayasam napasha, that thing is first required. Then the manta eva, the hard part. Offering obeisances. We already described. What does namaha mean? Ma means the ego, isn't it? Na means the negation of the ego. So negation of the self-asserting ego. Even the simple act of bowing down is a good beginning. It's not easy, even to do that. As a ritual, it's easy, but when you have to really do it from in the heart, that's very challenging. And it'll be challenged. It's usually challenging in the hearing process. I have my worldly experience telling me one thing, the sadhu is saying the exact opposite, then you get into difficulty. Then, jivanti samukaritam bhavadiya vartam. Samukaritam, the sadhus are speaking, bhavadiya vartam, glories of Krishna, jivanti, and you're living off of that. That is your only life support. Jivanti sam, just like you need anna, you need food grains to live. That, you don't forget about that, do you? Even while class is going on, you're thinking about that only. That's how bad the situation is. So in the same way, when you come to the point where shravanam from sadhu, that is my food grain, that's the only way I'm going to live. Then that's called sadhana bhakti. Otherwise, no sadhana going on. That's just socially viable religious life going on. And it looks like sadhana. Sadhana means this. This is my food grain. If I don't hear from sadhu, I don't hear that Hari Katha, that Hari Kirtan from sadhu, then I'll die. Just like if you don't eat grains, then what will happen? You'll die, isn't it? So when you come in that state of thinking, that sadhana, then it may be hope that you'll attain shravana. You'll attain kirtana. Otherwise, you will not attain shravana. It's not possible to attain shravana. It is sudurlabha. It is rarely attained. Very rarely obtained. So only when you do. But if it is possible to attain whatsoever, it is possible only by sadhana. Bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya. Bhakti that comes by bhakti means bhava that comes by sadhana. How would that be possible? If you practice sadhana like this, Just like now, class is going over, isn't it? When prasadam goes over, no one complains. Isn't it? Either externally or internally. Everyone is completely peaceful. Just eating, you already have a full belly. You say, okay, bring some more. No one, no complaints. But when class goes over, then great disturbance is there in the mind. Isn't it? Why class is already 15? Prabhu is 20. It's hitting 20 minutes over to class, Prabhu. Actually, we can go all the way until prasadam at least. 8:30 to 9 is time for your space out, isn't it? So we can go over, no problem. But we feel agitated, Prabhu. All right, at least it's not going through the prasadam time, so I'll forgive him. I'll forgive him this time. But actually, when you come to the point where, just like you don't complain when prasadam goes over, you don't complain when class is going over. You're just taking in that vibration like sweet nectar. Vayam tu nabha tripyama uttama shoka vikrame yashrimvatan rasaknanam swadu swadu pade pade. At every step, experience that I ever knew. Very nice, wonderful. Tadeva ramyam ruchiram navam navam. You know it now? Tadeva shashvan manaso mahotsavan tadeva shokarnava shoshanam nirna yarutama shoka yasho nigiyate. What is the translation? You tell. Yes. You're like the little kids that can recite chapters of Gita. They can't tell you a single meaning of the shloka. Tadeva ramyam. This harikata is beauty incarnate, you understand? Beauty incarnate, very attractive. And ruchiram, tasty. When you hear from sadhu, it's tasty. If you don't hear from sadhu, not tasty. That's a fact. And I read this just the other day from Sri Vishwanath's commentary on this famous verse, Satam Prasangam, Omavirya Samvido, Bhavanti Hre Karna Rasayana Kata. He says, when the kata is rasayanam, when it's tasty, then there's anarjanavritti. And if it's not, then he says it is only bhajana kriya, but no anarjanavritti. Heavy. When I read that, I was like, it was shivering. He said, this verse says, by intimate sangha with sadhus, satam prasangam, mama virya samvido, there is discussion of the wonderful virya activities of Krishna. So what happened? Bhavanti rit karna rasayana kata. Then it is very pleasing. Such topics are very pleasing to the ear and the heart. Rasayana kata is like an elixir which cures the heart of all nonsense. So this verse is actually explaining all the nine stages of bhakti according to Sri Vishwanath. So it begins with the previous verse which describes Shraddha. Then Satam Prasangam describes Sadhu Sangha. Then Mama Vira Samvido is Bhajana Kriya, because you're hearing the discussions of Krishna. So this is Bhajana Kriya. He says, if it becomes Bhavanti Hrit Karna Rasa Ayana Kata, Hrit heart, karna means ear, Rasa Ayana, a life-giving elixir for the ear and heart. Then he said there will be anarjanavritti. Otherwise, without that, he said there will only be Bhajana Kriya, but no anarjanavritti. That was very enlightening, actually. When I was like, whoa. So these topics are ruchiram. They're tasty. If you hear from sadhu, they're very tasty. You become attracted. You want to eat more and more and more. Navam, navam. Ever fresh. Just like, how many times were we talking about shravanam in this class, kirtanam? Same topics going on. Still finding interesting. Navam, navam. Ever fresh. Then tadeva shashvam anasomautuman. It is a constant festival for the mind. Otherwise, you in the nightmare only in the mind. All sorts of horrifying images coming up in the course of class, japa. Just like sometimes you see a devotee chanting japa and then all of a sudden. And from the distance you may be thinking, oh, he's getting absorbed. No, some image just came up. He's trying to get it out, trying to shake it off. Yeah, we know him for sure. It's not absorption. Because then after doing this for like 10 minutes, he get tired, didn't he? That's how you know. He's trying to shake it off. Some heavy image just popped up and he can't shake it off. Only reason you laughing because it's true. Otherwise, it wouldn't be that funny. Because it's happening. That's why you're laughing. So if you don't go to this festival, then you go to this hellish festival. It was like we went to, what is that, Grateful Dead? It was like being in hell. It was like, I was like, hell must be something like this, for sure. So you either go to the festival of Harikata or you go to these festivals, and the Mayan is coming. Chashram, constant, Manasa Mahotsavam, festival for the Mayan, and Tadeva Shoka Arnava Shoshanam. It dries up the ocean of grief, comprised of the tears of the conditioned souls. This material world is an ocean of grief comprised of the tears of conditioned souls. Isn't it? Everyone, the most pervading psychology in this material world is lamentation and fear. All pervasive. Shoka, moha, bhaya. Lamentation, fear, delusion. And the thing that you see most easily is lamentation. Although it's all grounded in fear, actually. Bhayam dutiya, as you see. So then this ocean lamentation can become dried up by hearing from sadhu. It's possible. Ya uttama shloka yashonigit. Therefore, let us hear these glories of uttama shloka sung by sadhus. Prithu Maharaj prays to have millions of ears. Why he wants millions of ears? Because the Lord has so many devotees everywhere. He wants to participate in all the discussions. So he prays to the Lord, may I be blessed with millions of ears. Similarly, Sri Vishwanath and his, it's called Sri Anuragi Bali, I think. Anuraga Bali, the divine, I forget the thing. We were just reading yesterday. So, anyway, I forgot what I was speaking about. I got carried away in the discussion. Oh, the topic was why Shravanam Kirtanam is hard to attain. That was the topic. But if it is at all possible to attain, it will be so only by sadhana. Sadhana, bhakti, bhaktiya, sanjataya, bhaktiya, only by bhakti, which if it's bhakti, it will be possible. And I already defined what sadhana is. When you take that hearing like you take grains to live, then you can say this is sadhana going on. Otherwise, there may be some type of sadhana. Bhajan and Kri may be there, but no Narjana Vritti would be going on. Or it would be going on so slow it's practically nil. Just like in Madhurya Kandamini, when discussing the nullification of Anarthas, 5 degrees are presented, right? The first one is called Eka Deshavartini, which means limited to one Anartha at a time. So that means a long time it's going to take there. That means your Bhajan and Kriya is only able to take out one Anartha at a time. You know, it's like you come in with a little, you know, like a whole army of the living dead is coming, you know. I often give the example of zombies. Even if you put a bullet in their head, it doesn't work, you know. You gotta really shoot them like 100 times before they knock. And their army, you got this little pistol. Those are your darnches coming to take you out. Hardly no effect coming. Then you start to get doubts. Does this process really work? So many doubts start to come up. Is this working? Ekadash Divartini, limited to one anartha. That's if you don't hear from sadhu. It's not going on. You're not hearing from sadhu. Then like this, taking a long time. And if you hear from sadhu, and the topics are relishable, and that's like fighting the army with the gigantic bazooka. You know, it takes out like hundreds of them at a time, you know. You know, you can barely control it. Then sadhana going on. That's sadhana bhakti. That's substantial. Then how it will be manifest? You become joyful. All the time happy. Just like I quoted the verse last night. Vadashraya katamrusha shrimvanti katayanti cha tapanti vividastapa naitam magata chetasaha. The verse says, those who take shelter of Krishna's delightful narrations. How do they do that? Shrimvanti katayanti cha. They hear them, they chant them. Then what is the result? Tapanti vividastapa naitam. There are no miseries for that sadhu. no adhyatmika klesha, no adhibhautika klesha, no adhidaivika klesha, no klesha, all finished. Then, magata chetasa, they remain fixed on the Supreme Lord, totally blissful, happy. So we hear from sadhu. Like this, then it may be possible to attain Shravanam Kirtanam Smaranam. Otherwise, no one can attain it. That's why it's so difficult. Why do you think we're struggling to do? It's not so easy to attain. That's why. You were like, your question. How do you hear? You need bhava, then you can really hear. Bhava and prema really allows for the hearing. Otherwise, in sadhana, this has got to be there, that quality. If I don't hear from sadhu, I'll die. Even if I am chanting 16 rounds, I'll die. Plenty of examples of that. Isn't it? You think I got in my ritual for the day? I'm good to go. You might die any moment. By chanting all my... What is that? It's good. Of course, dedication, we made our vows and all that. But this way you have to think, if I don't hear from sadhu, and I don't chant based on that hearing, I don't perform devotional service based on that hearing, then I'll die. I'll be finished. Then you can say sadhana is going on like that. That's why most of us, we're not yet doing sadhana fully, really. That's all right. But now at least we've got some ideal to work for. After all, here's the reality, here's the ideal. So now at least we have some ideal. May I one day attain sadhana bhakti. You already thought you were doing sadhana, isn't it? Now you got to go to the altar and pray to Krishna, may I one day attain sadhana. You thought you were doing sadhana bhakti. That's also not happening. Anyway, I'm being a little playful, but you get the gist of what I'm saying. It is not a very easy thing to attain. That's why we struggle to hear and chant. Because these processes are actually completely transcendental. There's nothing mundane about it. If it was mundane, it would be easier to attain. But if there was some mundane element, nothing mundane about it. That's why it's hard to attain. Even Bart Marsh could chant in a deer body, but we cannot chant in a human body. Isn't it? Because Bart Maharaj had attained Shravan Kirtan previous life. He attained Bhav. So even in their body he could chant, and we are not able to chant. We're struggling. Such is the extraordinary nature of bhakti. Totally transcendental. Alright, now 9 o'clock, so I'll not keep you from your breakfast. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Boga time?
Boga, please. Please don't wander off everywhere. My dear devotees. Shh.